As we enter a new year, many of us are going to be focusing on the strange year we've had and trying to extract some lessons that we've learned. Rather than do the same in today's episode of my podcast, I'd like to remind you of some of the foundations of lifetime investment success in my chat with Stuart Weems. And this is going to be a two-part episode. We're going to have a chat now and again next week. Now, to be clear, what we're going to talk about is very different from what you hear in the news, which basically focuses on short-term investment trends. You know, those headlines that have been saying things like 10 areas to invest in 2021, or the top 5 lessons from 2020, or what's the year ahead. Of course, there's always going to be short-term forecasts in property. But just look, what happened to all those forecasts made a year ago? And the about face all the economists had to make at the end of the year when their predictions were so wrong. It was much the same with the predictions made at the beginning of the year before, at the beginning of 2019, when there was the spectre of a Labour election win, and remember all those concerns about the change in property tax. Again, the short-term forecasts were wrong. But it's not just property forecasts we're hearing. Just look at the financial sections of the newspapers or the websites, and you'll read about the recent resurgence of the price of Bitcoin, or that the Australian stock market's almost at an all-time high. But only a few months ago, it was gold that was the flavour of the day. And who could forget the surge in tech shares at the height of the lockdown last year? These type of headlines tend to encourage us to short-term focus, and it encourages investors, or let's call them speculators, because that's really what they are, to try and time the market or look for the next big trend. But successful investing, like many things in life, is counterintuitive and countercultural. One of the core tenets of my approach to investing is that true lifetime investment success is goal-focused and plan-driven. And the good news is, by focusing on the long-term big-picture trends, it removes the burden of trying to guess correctly all those short-term trends such as interest rates, inflation, hotspots, and many of those other variables that the average analysts and many investors spend their days obsessing about. In a culture that's always going to be market-focused and performance-driven, my approach sees our clients at Metropole, and to be blunt, my personal investing, act on a financial plan. We build a customised strategic property plan for our clients rather than reacting to the vagaries of the market. And that's why I'm looking forward to my chat with Stuart Weems today, because I know he takes a very similar approach, and we're going to be discussing some of the fundamental laws that he wrote in his book Investopoly a number of years ago. Now, at Metropole, our approach is built on evidence-based foundation, and we discuss a lot of principles, but let me share 4 of mine before we go on to the ones with Stuart. Because if you master these, lifetime success is going to be available to you as well in your investment career. So the 4 principles I'd like to quickly mention to you is, first of all, faith in the future. While it's easier and more trendy to be a pessimist, I believe that optimism is the only realism. There are so many doomsayers out there, and I regularly get trolled by them, particularly on YouTube. But based on history, I confidently believe the ability of the capitalist society, Australia, to prosper on the back of our collective ingenuity. And if 2020 didn't teach you anything, it should have taught you that residential real estate in Australia is an asset class that's too big to fail. Neither the government, the Reserve Bank, or the private banks are going to allow it to fail. More than that, residential real estate is an asset class that you can use to build wealth because it's underpinned by a large proportion of owner-occupiers. You know, homeowners that would rather eat dog food than give up their homes or let the mortgagees take it over. And remember, 50% of these homeowners, they don't even have a mortgage against their home. They paid it off a long time ago. And a large percentage of the other homeowners have paid off a significant portion of their mortgage. So the first principle I want you to remember is, have faith in the future. Be an optimist. Optimists do so much better than pessimists. The second principle is patience. Contrary to the financially illiterate, strategic investors refuse to react inappropriately to disappointing events. And that's why they have a plan to follow, and they act on the plan rather than on the short-term ups and downs of the investment markets. They recognize that wealth is the transfer of money from the impatient to the patient. The third principle I'd like you to understand is that of discipline. Now, it's similar to the principle of patience, but discipline sees strategic investors continue to do the right thing, even if the fruits of their decision can't always be seen in the short term. And the fourth principle is strategic investors, successful investors, build a great team around them. You see, property investment's a process, not an event. In fact, property investment's a long-term process. It takes up to 30 years to develop financial independence through residential real estate. All the successful investors I know educate themselves. They want to become financially literate. But they're careful who they learn from, who they take advice from, because they've also learned that most educators and many so-called advisors have a vested interest. These successful investors also surround themselves with professionals and mentors, and they're prepared to pay for the advice to ensure that they maximize their investment returns. They want holistic advice, not just in the areas of property, but also finance, tax, structuring, legal matters, and estate planning. Yet while successful investors pay for their mentors, pay for their advice, the average investor gets their advice for free over the internet or on blogs or on YouTube. They haven't learned the simple fact that the cheapest advice is the one that gives you the best investment results. And obviously, you're not going to get that for free. On the other hand, the financially literate investors, they accept the guidance of their holistic wealth advisors. And if they've got sufficient discipline and allow the time, compounding and leverage to work its magic, their investment success is all but guaranteed. Now, while it's simple, it's not easy, and helping guide you in the right direction is the reason that this podcast exists. And as I said initially, we're going to have a chat now about some more important foundation principles. So welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropol, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Investing is easy when you know the rules. And according to my guest today, Stuart Weems, there are only 8 rules to investing. And if there are only 8 rules, it should be easy to win the game, just like it's easy to win the game of Monopoly if you know the rules. Now, if you don't know Stuart, he's an independent financial advisor, author of a number of books, including Investopoly and the Rules of the Lending Game. And he's a regular contributor to the Australian newspaper and clearly a regular guest on the Michael Yardney Podcast. Welcome, Stuart.
Michael, great to be with you again.
Now, I know you wrote the book Investopoly a couple of years ago, and we had a chat about it in my podcast way back in 2018. But boy, has the property market been up and down since then. So I thought it would be really interesting to see how your rules have stood the test of time through our changing property markets. We had an interesting experience in 2019. Even though those times were long forgotten, we've had even more challenges in 2020. So, Stuart, let's go back a step. You wrote a book. You called it Investopoly. Why did you write the book?
I wanted to write a book, Michael, because I think investing is relatively simple if you understand the mechanics of it, the fundamentals, the principles, if you like. And also, I think that very few financial mistakes result of random bad luck. In fact, I would say very, very few. Let's almost say none. And so therefore, most financial mistakes, or all financial mistakes, can be predicted before the person has implemented the strategy. And the reason for that is that there's a fundamental flaw. If people have invested in shares and haven't made money and then conclude, oh, I don't like investing in shares because it doesn't work. Or similarly with property, invested in property, didn't work out, had a bad tenant, didn't get any capital growth. And then they conclude, oh, property doesn't work. Well, it's not that. It's you've done something fundamentally unsound. You've done something wrong. It was never going to work from the get-go. And so I thought if we could just solidify that into 8 simple, easy-to-understand rules, and then what I can do is demonstrate to people, and certainly hope to do that through this conversation with you, Michael, that you can trace almost every mistake back to, or success, by the way, back to these 8 rules. You've either complied with them or you've broken them, and that's determined your outcomes.
Well, I know that was your fundamental principle a number of years ago. It'll be interesting to see as we work through them how they've stood the test of time, because we've almost had 1.5 or 2 property cycles in the last 2 years alone, haven't we? So rules, fundamentals are meant to see us through in the long term, through various economic challenges, through the good and the bad times, through the ups and downs in the cycle. So let's work through your rules. What's golden rule number one?
Focus on the long game, play the long game. You know, any sort of rules or principles are probably the most useful during times of high uncertainty, which I think describes, you know, the last couple of years for a varying degree. Obviously, the pandemic last year was a major issue, but in 19, the potential changes to tax legislation leading into a federal election in May 2019 caused a bit of upheaval as well, or uncertainty. In times of high uncertainty, it's really difficult to make financial decisions if you focus on the short run. And the reason for that is if you're focusing on the short term, it's uncertain because it's hard to visualize how things are going to play out. It's hard to visualize what's going to happen over the next 2 months or 6 months or 12 months or even 2 years, for example. And if we think back to the beginning of last year when the pandemic hit, there was so much uncertainty. No one knew what was going to happen. Would there be a vaccine next week? Would it take many years? What is the mortality rate? How is the virus spreading by air? You know, these sorts of things like we didn't understand. And so if all we did in that time is just focused on what's going to happen in 2020 or 2021, we would get paralyzed. We couldn't make a decision, or we would make the wrong decision. You know, we'd sell our investments or do something like that. So focusing on the long game promotes you to avoid making mistakes and makes you, forces you to sort of focus on the fundamentals. The fundamentals would be if I buy a high quality asset, an asset that is benefits from perpetual excessive demand in a great location where people are always going to want to live, that has demonstrated a strong track record of growth. If I did that in at the beginning of 2020, and all I'm doing is focusing on what would the outcomes be by 2030 or 2040, for example, we're thinking in multiple decades, then I would know that, yeah, great, buying a property was a great thing to do. And we also know now, I think we can relatively confidently say, looking back, if we bought a property last year, it was probably a good decision. You know, obviously it depends on the type of property and the actual asset, but as long as we're buying investment grade asset, it actually was the right decision to buy when no one else was that confident to do so. So focusing on, keep asking yourself the question, what can I do today so that in 10 years time plus, I'm financially stronger? And if you keep asking yourself that question, it promotes you to make better financial decisions.
Well, clearly this rule, your golden rule number one, has stood the test of time, because I've often said don't make 30-year investment decisions on the last 30 minutes or even the last 30 days of news. I think the other thing we learned over the last couple of years is how experts get it so wrong. If we think back to the beginning of 2020, all the experts, not just the negative Nellies and all those who always say the property market's going to fall, Stuart, but the bank economists all predicted 10, 15, 20, some even up to 30% drops. And then they had to do an about face at the end of last year when they realized they were wrong. But go back the year before, how many people predicted or were concerned about what the impacts of tax changes would be? You're right. It's really hard to make short-term decisions in long-term asset games, as property investment is. So I guess property investment is really a process. It's actually a long-term game. It's not just an event that you get over and done with. Rule number two, Stuart.
Rule number two is really know how much income you're aiming for and by when. So, you know, if we aim at nothing, that's exactly what we tend to achieve, is nothing. But if we're going to start out and think about retirement, or at least having more flexibility to work when you want to work, or whatever it might look like for you, if you don't set a goal, it's very difficult to develop a plan. It's a little bit like, you know, leaving home without a destination. You just drive around aimlessly and you end up making ad hoc financial decisions, and I'll invest in this year and Bitcoin next year and something else that that's a fad. You get distracted by shiny objects and you don't really know whether these decisions are actually helping you get closer to that longer term goal or further away. So by setting a goal, it gives you a context. It gives you a context for which measuring financial decisions. So you know that, look, if my goal is $80,000 of passive income by the time I'm 60, and I go and buy a holiday house with and rack up $1 million of non-deductible debt, that's probably going to force me further away from achieving that goal rather than closer to it. And I then can make a decision based on what I have today in terms of assets and what I expect in terms of future income, whether that's a prudent decision. Whereas I find that when you ask people, certainly when I meet new prospective clients, and I say, what does retirement look like for you? How much money do you need? Virtually no one can answer it, Michael, or they pull out the stock standard $100,000 a year.
And $100,000 hasn't changed, Stuart. They used to ask for that 20 years ago, 10 years ago. They're still asking for that today. That won't go very far, will it?
Well, it just depends on people's lifestyles and what their goals are and what they want to do in retirement. I guess, just picking and plucking a figure out of the air seems like a really silly thing to do for something that is so incredibly important. Because really, if I'm going to toil away at my profession for 20, 30, 40 years, work hard, make sacrifices, invest well, I want to make sure that, or at least as sure as I can, that when I get to where I want to be, which is might be retirement or partial retirement, whatever that looks like, that I don't that I'm going to enjoy the standard of living that I hope to enjoy. I don't want any surprises at that stage because it's too late. Like if I don't have enough money and I've got to make some compromise and I can't go on a European holiday every couple of years or even every year, I don't want to find that out when I'm 60 or 65 or 70 when I'm ready to do that. I want to know now when I've got enough runway still left to make some changes, to change what I'm spending or to be a bit more aggressive or less aggressive, depending on the situation. So it's important to set a goal. The thing is we shouldn't get too paralyzed that it needs to be a perfect goal. If I sit down and think, oh, I want 200 grand by the time I'm 60, that's okay. That's something then to start aiming for. As you get closer, as you get older, as you change your wants and desires, you know, maybe that goal becomes something completely different. It's less money. Maybe I feel like I don't need a lot of stuff in my life, for example. That's okay. You can just adjust the goal. But having no goal, what's the point? You don't have then a context for making financial decisions.
So it goes back to what Stephen Covey said in his Habits of Successful People. You begin with the end in mind. But then you've also got to have more than the goal. I believe you've got to have a strategy. And I know in your firm, you have strategic wealth advice, tax advice, finance advice. We give the strategic property advice. Because then you've got to see, is your goal realistic? And then what you have to do, and just as importantly, what you shouldn't do to be able to achieve your goal. I think the other thing people forget is how long that long holiday they're going to have at the end is. If they retire at 60, 65, it's going to be the longest holiday of their life. And holidays tend to be reasonably expensive to live, so they probably won't have enough money. I'm not sure that we can count on superannuation or the government to fund that very long holiday we're hoping to have, Stuart.
Longevity risk, as it's called, is outliving your money, is a bit of a problem. I mean, it's a good thing, obviously, from a lifestyle perspective, but from a financial perspective, it's challenging. So I am 46 today. The stats suggest that I will die somewhere in my sort of early to mid 80s, 84, whatever. So that means I've got maybe just slightly less than 40 years left on this planet, Michael. I could sit down and build a financial plan based on that. But what do I think is going to happen to medical technology and processes and these sorts of things over the next 40 years? Well, they're probably going to improve. So I don't know. I mean, it's going to be different for everyone and their history and so forth about how long you want to plan for. But when I develop a plan for a client, I like to make sure that my net worth continues to increase into retirement rather than reduce, so that we're not eating into capital and we're not going to run out of money. So if our net worth continues to increase, it means mathematically we can live forever, or at least we can afford to live forever. Whether we're going to live forever, none of us are Peter Pan, so it's probably not going to happen.
So what we're doing is working through your golden rules of investment from your book Investopoly. And when you talked about the golden rule number two, know how much income you need and by when, I remember you also made a comment about once people go into retirement, there's an increased risk of depression. Many people aren't feeling they're contributing anymore, they're not growing anymore. So some people are going to keep working, some people are going to need to keep working, but you've also got to have something to do in retirement. And if you have funds behind you, it's going to give you more options, more choices moving forward.
Yeah, that's right. So there's two things based on Maslow's hierarchy of needs that practitioners think that are lacking when people end or can be lacking when people enter retirement if they don't really think clearly about it. It's about personal growth is one. And then secondly, contributing outside of yourself to something outside of yourself, like a community or those sorts of things. And typically we get those or we fulfill those needs at work. You know, at work, we learn new skills. We're constantly kind of testing ourselves and learning different situations, experiences. And secondly, we tend to be contributing something we believe in, something a little bit bigger than us. We're not going to work just to get a paycheck at the end of the week. Typically, we're connected with the work that we're doing. We're doing work that we're proud of. And so they're the two things that that tend to disappear if we stop doing paid employment, that tends to disappear. So it's always good to think about, okay, it's great to have enough financial resources to enjoy retirement, but there's only so many rounds of golf or so many lunches that you can participate in. What else am I going to do to fulfill those two needs?
That's very important. So as we work through the golden rules of investing from Stuart Weems' book, Investopoly, golden rule number three is a standard one we've all heard before, but how many of us are actually practicing it? Spend less than you earn and invest the difference regularly. I like that last word at the end.
Yes. And, you know, cash flow management is absolutely critical. I mean, it's impossible. I would say it's impossible to build wealth if you're spending all your income or more. Sometimes people are spending more than their income, which is a road to disaster, really. Of course, it means that you've got to start to know what you're spending your money on. And to a lot of people, that feels like budgeting, that feels like making sacrifices that they're not necessarily willing to make. And that all feels too painful and they don't really want to do it. So they think, oh, I'll get to that. You know, they push it aside. But the reality is that with investing, there is unfortunately always a little bit of delayed gratification required, particularly at the beginning of your investment journey. Once you start building assets and start steamrolling, still there's some delayed gratification, but there's less in my experience anyway. If you can make some sacrifices, you know, instead of going on a holiday, contribute those monies towards a deposit to another investment property, for example, that is a short-term sacrifice that's going to pay significant long-term outcomes. But of course, you can't do that. You can't make those decisions. You can't invest until you know you have some investment capital in order to contribute towards your retirement, whether that's going to go towards debt reduction, super contributions, funding investment properties, investing in the share market, or whatever it might be, depending on what your financial plan is, you need to have something to make regular contributions to. And so, Michael, the best way that I've found in order to do that is to separate your expenses into two separate accounts. You have one account where you pay all your non-discretionary items, you know, your mortgage repayments, your insurance bills, you know, all the sort of boring stuff that, you know, you're not, that's just regular, it's pretty predictable, and you're probably not overspending in those categories. I mean, it's good to look at your electricity bill and prices and so forth, of course, periodically, but they're not major items. And then you have a separate account that you pay all your discretionary expenses. If you go out for coffee or dinner, buy some clothes, the sort of things that could be zero or it could be $1,000. And what you do is you transfer a regular amount into that discretionary account. And that might be $500 a week. It might be whatever you determine is the right amount for you. And then you spend away. You don't need to track every single dollar and cents, but you know if you're transferring $500 across every week and you're 2 days into that week and you've got nothing in the bank, you know, you need to pull it back and you can kind of course correct. And what that does is subconsciously, it makes people think carefully about what they're spending. It's a relatively painless experience. They can subconsciously change their spending habits and they don't feel like they're making sacrifices because it's all the unconscious expenditure that hurts. It's the, oh, buy a coffee. You don't even think about it and it's gone. And you make several of them per day or per week and you multiply that by 52 or 12, depending on what you're doing. And over a year, course of a year, those things add up. And those things, particularly with low interest rates today, could equal the holding costs of another investment property, for example. So they're costly.
It's the old concept of putting things in jars, as our grandparents used to do before there were bank accounts or the various credit cards that you could get. So I think you wrote in your book some clever words. You said, if you're not a saver, rather than using the word saving, redefine it as future spending because it is your future money. So understand where your money is going and we've got to, as you say, spend less than you earn. The problem a lot of people have is not only spending what they earn, but they spend what's on their credit card, Stuart. They see their credit card limit as their money as well, and it's not, it's the banks.
Yeah, exactly right. And look, it's a problem. It's a growing problem. A good thing to see last year was, you know, credit card balances going down, people making significant repayments. But of course, then it doesn't take into account the sort of buy now, pay later, afterpay kind of providers that are probably eating up some of that. I mean, it's just something you just shouldn't be participating in. If you can't afford it, if you don't have the cash in the bank, don't buy it. It's that simple. And it's an old-fashioned rule, right? But look, if we want to be successful, and we want to teach our kids to be successful at managing money, well, then the best thing we can do is follow these basic but very fundamental and important principles.
I think it's a great point you made because we are our children's mentors. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So it's not just what we say, it's also what we do, what they see us do in handling of money. So money management is a critical factor in getting onto the property ladder, but then also continuing on the property ladder. Golden rule number four was grow your asset base first and then tilt towards income. I guess that's the old story of you, do you invest for capital growth or cash flow, Stuart?
Yeah, correct. And people think, well, I've got personal exertion income. I've got to go out and earn my income. And if I don't go out and earn, I have no income. And so therefore, if I want that, they sort of connect the dots to sort of say, logically, if I want to not have to go to work, then I need passive income. And so, okay, let's start investing for passive income so I can gradually replace my earned income. To use an analogy, a golfing analogy, it's a little bit like teeing off with a putter. You know, a putter is for those that don't know much about golf, a putter is a club that's used on the green. It's for small shots, small accurate shots. It's not for distance. So you're using the wrong club for the wrong shot, but you might actually get there in the end. It might take you 30 shots to get to the green. So it might work, but it's not the right club. You'll look like an idiot doing it. Also, what you really need to do is first focus on investing in assets that are going to grow your asset base, your net worth. Then once you've got a substantial net worth, then you can start tilting towards income. And the reason why that is the most efficient way is because of the nature of compounding capital growth. You don't pay tax on capital growth each and every year it occurs. Of course, you pay tax if and when you sell the asset, but you get to reinvest that pre-tax growth each and every year, and it compounds, and it's like a snowball. So if someone walks into my office today and says, Stuart, I've got a net worth of $500,000, I want $80,000 a year. I'm going to live for another 40 years to develop an investment strategy. I'm going to say to them, get out of my office. It's impossible. Yeah. Maybe I'll be a bit more polite than that.
No, you'd be more polite than that.
But if someone says, oh, I've got $5 million net worth, well, okay, then there's lots of different strategies we can probably compare and find the most appropriate one. So it really is about building your net worth first. And so if you're young, or if you've got a small net worth, it's about investing in assets that provide most of their return in capital growth. And so when we compare, say, long-term returns in the share market and the property market, they look relatively comparable. But when you have a look at the makeup of those returns, and particularly if you're, and I don't advise to do it, but particularly if you're investing in actively managed investments in the share market, most of your return is going to be in income. either realized gains or dividends. And so you're going to pay a lot of tax along the way. Whereas if you look at property, particularly houses, for instance, your net income after expenses is actually quite small as a percentage of the overall asset, but the growth is significant. And that's really mathematically, it's not an opinion. I can demonstrate that just with simple maths. That's the quickest way to build wealth.
Well, when you think about it, when you retire or move to your golden years or slow down, most of your assets aren't going to be money that you've earned. It's not going to be rent that you've received. It's not dividends that you've received. It's going to be the tax-free capital growth partly in your house. That's what most Australians do, and that's all they're left with. Or if you're an investor, in the properties that you've bought. Interestingly, as the value of the properties goes up, so does the rent. But most people get it wrong, as you say. Most people say, oh, I want to buy a property investment so it'll pay for my school fees. I want to buy a property investment so I can use the money to go on holidays. That's not how real estate works. In Australia, residential real estate is a high growth, relatively low yield investment, even though today the yield is very good compared to previous years when the holding costs are so low. So you're right, you've got to compare the two sorts of investments, and not all returns are the same. The grossed up return of rent and capital growth may look the same. You're getting more rent, less capital growth, but if you're paying tax on what you're left with isn't the same in a high cash flow investment. But then people sort of wonder, what do I do then? How do I get to the point of living off my property portfolio? And Stuart, I know you recognize that years ago I talked a bit about living off equity. That doesn't work anymore. The banks have changed the rules. So it's a long journey, 20, 30 year journey of building an asset base and then slowly lowering your loan to value ratios and having a mix of assets, a mix of assets that include income assets, shares, superannuation fund, maybe business for some people. So there's a number of ways of getting there. I know we've spoken about it before, so maybe we should finish our chat in this podcast, because I want to discuss the other four rules next week, with how do you then get to the point of living off your property portfolio. And Stuart, maybe I can start with the concept of you've got to end up with your own home with no debt, and then you've got to have a cash machine. And that cash machine could be a blend of assets that bring income growth and capital growth.
It's spot on. And you've got to think about then debt reduction and interest rate sensitivity as well. So in retirement, when I'm reliant on just investment income, typically, for those that are lucky to get a defined benefit pension or something, that's different. But for most people, it's either dividends or rental income. I don't want to have a high sensitivity to interest rates. I don't want to have to watch the TV, listen to the RBA announcement every single time and panic that they're going to increase interest rates and I'm not going to be able to, you know, my standard living is going to have an impact. But having zero debt's probably not necessarily either. You can probably have some level of debt. And that's going to really then determine sort of the net cash flow from property. Because if you have no debt against a substantial property asset, you're probably going to do okay. It'll fund, maybe it won't fund 100% of your living expenses, but maybe it'll fund more than 50% of them. And therefore, you need less super or less other assets in order to fund retirement. But you do need to start thinking more broadly. And you need to think about not just ignore super. A lot of people do ignore super. And I acknowledge the how people think about it. They're not in control of it. The government can change the rules, all these sorts of things. But the reality is that it's a very tax-effective environment, that it forces us to make long-term investment decisions. It is our money and we need to look after it and make sure it's invested well. And it can play a role in an investment strategy. It might not necessarily need to play a fundamental role. Maybe it doesn't need to fund a large portion, but it can underpin your property investment. And the way I like to think about it sometimes with clients is I say, look, super will fund the first phase of retirement. Let's call it the first 10 years if you don't have a lot of super, for example. So that just gives your investment property portfolio another decade to produce better returns, to make the debt look less material. You know, as your asset value grows, your debt's going to stay the same. Plus also inflation kind of eats away at the debt value as well. You know, borrowing $100,000 today doesn't seem like a big amount, but in the 80s, it was a big amount. So it needs to be holistic, I think, and taking a broader view rather than just thinking, I'm going to go buy 3 properties or 10 properties. You know, how's it going to work?
Sure. So that's all part of having a plan, as we've spoken about on a number of occasions. And your financial model has to also decide how you're going to live off your property portfolio in the long term. Now, I know there are some people out there saying buy 10 properties, sell 5, and you're left with 5 with no debt. Doesn't work that way, because if you're buying the 10 properties, you're probably going to have 80% loan-to-value ratio against them. When you sell them, you're hopefully going to pay some capital gains tax if you bought the right properties. So you've really got to have a plan of debt reduction. And sometimes that even involves selling a property. I know neither you or I like that, but if that's what you've got to do, you've bought the properties to give you a lifestyle, not just to own a set number of assets.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think that's the whole benefit of planning, Michael, is if we know we will sell an asset one day, we can start thinking about its ownership structure and prioritizing minimizing capital gains tax over, say, land tax consequences or income tax consequences. Maybe we would pick a structure like a trust or a self-managed super fund, knowing it might give us less in terms of negative gearing, but it will help us substantially around reducing capital gains tax. And that will be far more effectual from a debt reduction perspective than being too short-term focused and trying to reduce my tax next year. So by able to sit down and plan, we can think about these things. We can put it in context. How important is contributing additional monies into super? If super's not going to play a massive role because you want to retire before 60, for example, then at least you've got that context. You don't need to agonize whether you should be or shouldn't be making those extra contributions.
So what we're doing is working through your great book, Investopoly, The 8 Rules of Investing, The Golden Rules. And these are irrefutable rules. They're rooted in math. They're rooted in logic. They're rooted in evidence as opposed to your gut feel. And not surprisingly, they have stood the test of time. So I look forward to coming back again next week and having another chat with you. But before we finish off, Stuart, if people want to get a copy of this book, which I'd highly recommend, how do they get Investopoly? Because being a couple of years old, you won't find it in bookshops anymore.
No, maybe not. So if you just Google Investopoly, it'll take you to our website, to prosolution.com.au, and you can buy it off there. You can use the code, your surname, Yardney, and you'll get a discount. You can buy it for $20, no postage.
That's a good deal. And of course, that's also the name of your podcast, which I look forward to listening to each week, which is the you talk through your weekly blogs, which are great as well. I look forward to catching up with you again next week to discuss the next 4 rules, Stuart.
It's been fantastic, Michael. Thanks a lot.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. But I just want to remind you that this is the first of a 2-part series with Stuart Weems. Next week, I'll be back with the rest of his investment fundamentals from his book, Investopoly. But I hope what you got out of today was the importance of structuring and planning your future. Investment success doesn't just happen. And in our current markets, where there are still going to be many challenges, you can't just go off and buy any property and hope it's going to work for you. Sure, we're going to have a couple of good years in property, but boy, are there going to be some headwinds and some problems and challenges as well. So to secure your financial future, you're going to need more than just a buyer's agent. They can buy properties, but they can't give the holistic advice, and they usually have a vested interest because of where they're going to recommend you buy. You're going to need more than a property strategist. You need somebody to give you a holistic approach to help you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth. And that's what my team at Metropole can do for you. We can help level the playing field. We can give you direction in these new times. We can give you certainty based on, well, over $4 million worth of property transactions, and the success, the statistics that show that more of our investors end up having 5, 6, 7 properties, 7 times more than the average Australian investor. And we also have a range of services, including financial planning, wealth advisory, property management, project renovations, development. We can help you, whether you're a beginning investor getting into the market, an experienced investor growing your portfolio, or a sophisticated investor who wants to grow their portfolio even faster by manufacturing capital growth through renovations or development. So why not go to metropole.com.au and have my team as part of your team to help you take advantage of the new wave of the property cycle.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to share with you one of the lessons that I learned from one of my early mentors, the late Jim Rohn. Jim Rohn said, don't be a complainer. He explained there's room for legitimate complaining, but if you let this deadly disease, the disease of complaining, loose, it will conquer you. He said, complaining can take over your life. He said, it can destroy you and leave you without anything. Jim Rohn said, nobody wants to be with a complainer. Nobody wants to promote a complainer. Nobody wants to live with one. Nobody wants to be a partner with one. Nobody wants to be around a complainer. Jim Rohn said, complaining leaves you out of more opportunities than you can possibly imagine, especially if you let it take over, if you let it grab you by the throat. Now, Jim Rohn gave a great analogy. He said, if you don't think complaining is bad, ask the children of Israel, the children of the Old Testament fame. He said, they're typical of all of us, but their story just happened to get into the book. Jim Rohn explained, the story says the children of Israel were slaves in Egypt. God performed a series of dazzling miracles and gets them out. Now they've got their freedom and they're heading for the promised land. But the tragedy of the story here, they never got there. They never got to the promised land, did they? And the reason was from day one, they started to complain. They griped about their food. They had just been delivered from slavery and there they are complaining about their food. They whined and cried and griped about the water. In the desert, they had water to drink, but it didn't taste that good. They whined and complained about their leadership. They'd just been delivered from slavery. And then they complained it was too hot, too cold, too far, too difficult, too rocky. They whined and they cried for years, 40 to be exact. And finally, God said, I've had it. Trip cancelled. So Jim Rohn says, the story says that they died in the desert and never reached the promised land after all that trouble. Jim Rohn believes the story's got two good teachings for us, and I agree with him. Number one, he said, indulging in complaining long enough and you're going to get your future cancelled, future promotions, future opportunities. And the second lesson is, even God himself can only take so much complaining. I guess you've got my point, haven't you? Complaining is not for winners in life. You must focus on what you can do, not what you can't do. You must focus on opportunities, not on difficulties. And when you do this, you're not only going to inspire yourself, but you'll be an example for others around you to follow you as well. So there's a great lesson from one of my early mentors, Jim Rohn. Don't be a complainer. Don't be a whinger. There's no such thing as a rich victim. As I've said a couple of times, I'll be back next week with part two of this two-part series where we go through more of Stuart's investment fundamental rules. But if you got some benefit from today's show, I'd really appreciate it if you told somebody about it. There's a share button on every podcast app, or just do it the old-fashioned way and actually tell somebody, because just like my aim in this new year is to help you become more successful financially and in other areas of your life as well, I'd like you to help me with my aim of helping as many Australians as possible achieving financial literacy. So just tell somebody about the show or tell the world about it by leaving a review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to this show. Now, I'm going to be back again, as I said, next week with the next episode having a chat with Stuart. But if you want to catch up with me in between, just watch out for me on social media and you just look for Michael Yardney. And if you want to get daily commentary from me that's exclusive, go to the Property Update Facebook group. Just look up Property Update group in Facebook and you'll have even more content from me. Look forward to catching up with you again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?